Hello and welcome to Label Sessions Presents, the podcast where we talk to the most interesting people about all the things you need to know in the world of innovation, business, design, tech, and culture. I'm Fazlin Esau, joining all the way from Cape Town, South Africa. And today we're joined by two brand new additions to the roster, as well as Label Sessions founder, Nick Sherrod. Nick, what are we looking at this week?
So this week we're picking up on how we spot good and bad use cases for AI. So there's a lot of people promising different ones. So how do we spot the good ones from the bad ones? We also want to speak around how the world of sustainability should respond to what some people are calling the mask off era. So certainly lots of people challenging the sort of sustainability agenda just now. And we also want to talk around how important job titles are in the C-suite, partly inspired by the new announcements from Sabre, a company that lots of people around Label Sessions know very well, one of the leading travel tech companies in the world. But how important are the job titles in the C-suite of a big company? And then finally, just briefly, we're just going to talk around the Super Bowl, because it was the Super Bowl last night. I'm in the UK, so last night, yesterday, if you're in the US. And in particular, we want to ask, does the Super Bowl matter outside America?
Let's introduce our new label mates who are coming to us from across the world today. First up, Shafiq Nasser. Shafiq is a leader in transportation, mobility, and cybersecurity innovation, and our go-to expert in autonomous travel. He's been working with multiple technology and mobility startups, as well as the US and UAE government agencies. Shafiq, what is exciting you right now in the world of autonomous innovation?
Well, what's exciting me right now is if you look at it, ultimately, everything is going to become autonomous. I mean, we started with an approach where autonomous vehicles are on the ground, but now you're talking about eVTOLs, which is the electric vehicle takeoff and landing. Then they're talking about ferries and ships. I mean, the idea is that if we can take transportation away from the driver, then transportation will become more safe, and it will become, at the end of the day, believe it or not, the fact is that roads are still more dangerous than the skies. Okay, it's still safer to fly than to drive on the road. And a lot of that is to do with the fact that when you're on the road, as much as you are a careful driver, the statistics is you have many more other drivers around you that become risk factors. Okay, so what's exciting is if we can get to a level where there is more autonomous, where we can enable, cars with this. And the exciting part behind it is the infrastructure itself becomes a whole, tectonic shift and a whole paradigm shift. Because today, if you want to have fully autonomous cars, then you're having talking cars. Earlier, I was saying Kit and Knight Rider, but really cars talking to each other and cars communicating with each other. You're really talking about, a kind of an ecosystem where the vehicles are driving themselves, communicating with one another, and an infrastructure that becomes more seamless and less kind of packed and congested, okay? Because everything becomes more about data integration, data transfer. The other exciting part is with the eVTOLs, and you look at vertipods, just imagine that if you want to get to the airport and you are one of those people that's very, gets very concerned about traffic and making your plane on time, the concept is you take the eVTOL or the air taxi from one vertipod to another, go down and go to the airport and catch your plane. So, the closest I can get to this is like Star Wars, Star Trek. This is what we see in Hollywood. This is what we see on TV. But if we are going there and we are going to make it a reality, it's going to be exciting because of how it will completely transform transportation and mobility. And it'll also be exciting because of what it will do to the future of infrastructure and the technologies and the innovations and the opportunities that will be presented. I mean, to every technologist, like Raj Kapoor was speaking earlier, at the age of 20, he's delving and playing with technology, or 28. This is like, for us, this is like candy, it's like candy. It's what we enjoy to play around it.
Incredible. We're also joined by Raj Kapoor, founder of India Blockchain Alliance, the largest Indian emerging technology tech think tank. Raj is also a global blockchain, cryptocurrency, and fintech educator, a certified Bitcoin professional, and a blockchain solutions architect. Raj, what is the conversation you think leaders need to be having right now around blockchain?
I think the biggest conversation globally is regulation, compliance, standards, frameworks. That was the theme of G20. I'm proud to be part of the G20 committee as well, the global G20 committee, which talked about this. And happy to say that five of my suggestions have been incorporated inside, hopefully, the framework which churned out. Now, that's a good thing. Yeah, that's one of the biggest conversations because, see, blockchain is a great technology, but it's the Wild West with blockchain if it's not regulated. It's also the same with artificial intelligence. Now, these are two wonderful technologies which have a beautiful confluence, but at the same time, they're both not regulated. And that brings out a solution and a problem by itself, a challenge. Yes, it's a challenge, but then again, that brings out more innovation. And I believe all challenges do that. So the biggest conversation right now in this part of this neck of the woods is policy, is compliance, frameworks, taxation. These are the big topics. Yes, technology is great. It can do a lot of things. AI can do a lot of things. What about the ethics? That's another conversation going around. The ethics around artificial intelligence. We have had n number of lawsuits because of lack of the ethics being filtered right at the beginning. Now, these two conversations, I believe, are the biggest. However, let's put it the other side. There's another conversation. While we talked about EVs, we talk about all you know, sustainable technologies, etc., we really have to question ourselves another conversation. How sustainable are these technologies? Blockchain, for example, in the earlier stages, was a great energy guzzler. Data centers guzzle water like anything. You take the data center of Microsoft, you can make 312 Teslas in a year. That's a lot of water we use. That's a scarce resource. Are we doing the right thing? Yes, some of the electric vehicles are using lithium batteries. Has somebody really gone into the depth of what it requires to make a lithium battery? That's a huge question mark. And a lot of people just gloss over it. But the fact is, it's there. And it runs on lithium batteries. So yeah, we need the resources. Anyway. The conversations I believe are around policy, sustainability, and longevity of these technologies going forward. And what we're doing here, at least in most of the developing countries, we are working a lot now towards a concept called Tech Zero, which we've initiated. A Tech Zero is nothing but you're using technology, we evaluate what is the right technology, what could be a replacement for it, to get you better results and make the world a better place to live in for all of us. So I think two conversations which are really predominant, policy and sustainability. And I think these should be addressed before we talk about any other innovation. Otherwise, innovation will get impacted at some point of time. And if it doesn't, then I'm actually not wanting to be in this world then if it's not. If we don't, do that. So I think these conversations, this part, lots of conversation, lots of chatter. Let's hope we see some results now.
100%. And that kind of leads really nicely into our first topic that Nick mentioned, and that is, how do we spot good and bad uses of AI? So there've been a couple of stories about various uses of AI. Y Combinator is saying that we should all find a vertical AI agent to build. A new startup has developed something to decode social video. And then we also have this idea of people using chatbot and AI to break up with people. So all of these crazy things happening, what's good, what's bad, how should we all find the best use cases for AI, and when should we not be using it at all, like perhaps in breaking up with a significant other?
Well, AI is, a lot of people just use it for a lot of hype. Good use cases, if it's really solving a problem, not if it's just creating a more hype. I've seen a lot of young startups come up, AI-based, this AI-based, that AI-based solutions. Frankly speaking, AI has been here for the last 60 years. We've been using the algorithm since donkey's years. So I mean, it's nothing, it's just a lovely word to use now, maybe to get better valuation for your organizations or companies. That's one of the things. So you should look at it inside out. I like to see people using that inside out. when AI adds, sometimes AI just adds a lot of complexity without any value. That's when you should avoid AI. Good use cases, there are plenty. In the healthcare space, yes, we get the cancer by just looking at, in fact, in India, we are right now setting up a whole series of smart clinics where you just walk inside. AI captures your, it's already got data. We've already got the AI data of everybody. Your face becomes your wallet. It becomes everything. So when I walk into a community clinic, by the time I reach the desk, my entire health records are there right in front of me because it's using AI and blockchain. The blockchain keeps the records and the AI diagnosis so that you have a diagnosis. The doctor, of course, is sitting there to see the diagnosis is accurate. You need the human interface, that's for sure. So I think that's a great use of AI. It saves time, effort, money. And in India, where there's a huge, huge, huge country, some people can't even walk to the hospital or it's far away. But there are community centers where they can just walk in there, just have a look at the screen, and you get diagnosed right there and then. What telemedicine used to do before, AI is a great use of actually solving that problem. I think that is a great use of AI. Another great use of AI and blockchain, I would say these technologies work in tandem. They don't work in isolation. It's one of the biggest misconceptions that all technologies work in isolation. They don't. They work in tandem, and they should have integrated. So, I don't know whether we know that the oceans around us are actually dying. We have about 12 to 15 years left in the oceans, in the water. There's effluents, plastic, overfishing, a lot of things. Can we solve that problem using technologies? So is a yes, we can solve those problems because we can take out all the innovations in the world, all the everything of the future, but if we don't have humanity and life, we've got nothing left. And our oceans are a classic example of what we are destroying our environment. How will we use technology to do that? I'll tell you. There is a project, beautiful project, which I'm working on. It's called SEA. Okay, C.Earth is the website. And have a look at it. It's actually, it's the world's largest citizen scientist project in which you just pick up your phone, you just download the app and keep it on. That's all. There's no cost to it. While your app is on, it collects all the data from around us, the humidity, the temperature, everything. It locks it on the blockchain so that there's no manipulation of the data and the accuracy of the data is maintained. We use analytics and artificial intelligence to predict weather patterns, weather models, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In fact, we actually did a lot of work and we did predict the LA fires recently. We did predict that there will be a, due to the climatic change, it was a different thing that nobody took us very seriously. Now they are. At that time, nobody took us seriously. We also predicted in deserts how to make water basins, all using this information, because this information now locked on blockchain, the accuracies cannot be compromised using AI, data analytics, and IoT devices, of course, to pick up all the data. And that's all you need is to keep your phone on. That's it. And everything is there real time.
If I may just add to what Roger's saying, this is a very interesting question because, if you go into any technology conference today, AI is like, being put in big, bold letters. Going to what Raj said, I think the issue is that today, before you talk about, you need to know what problem you're trying to solve. Like, I remember that you would go and you sit with all these technology companies and they directly jump in and they say, we have AI. What is AI? Yeah. What do you have for AI? We have an AI algorithm. What is your algorithm? It's an AI type of algorithm. Like it's using the buzzwords. Like I remember when we were in Babson College, our professor would always tell us, don't use the buzzwords. Talk about the value. Talk about the message. Talk about the real solution. What are you trying to say here, right? And I really, the one company that got my attention is when I went there and I said, I'm like, so what kind of AI solution do you have? The first thing the guy said, looked at me and said, well, what problem are you trying to solve? But if you want to look at, the bad, the good, the bad, and the ugly, as they'd like to say, for example, the other day, my daughter comes up to me and says, Dad, why am I going to school? And I'm like, to go study. Of course, that's where you go. You go to school to study. She's like, but we're using Copilot, and they're teaching us how to use it. And since it has all the answers, then I'll never get it wrong. I'm like, no, No. Time out. You're using Copilot. That's good. They're teaching you a sort of generative tool, which is great. Generative AI. They're trying to get you up and trying to get you into the trend. But at the end of the day, you need to be smarter than the generative AI. You need to be the one that says to Copilot, this is wrong. This is junk. This is garbage. Okay, let me tell you. You don't just sit there and surrender. That's one.
Yeah.
Second, where I think AI should not be used is to compromise and to take away human genuity, authenticity, and creativity. You know, if you want to solve a problem like today in mobility and transportation, where's AI playing a role in video analytics? Because you've got hundreds and thousands of cars on the road, on these traffic congestions, and you cannot decipher the situation with a human eye. You cannot look at an accident, look at a incoming, you know, you can't. You need the video analytics. You need the AI algorithm. That is a great case study. But this one that I read where someone used AI to break up, I mean, this is human emotions. This is human relations. This is where you need the human touch.
What we're actually saying across the whole piece here is that AI is really a great use case for AI is to bring intelligence to something where it's currently not very intelligent, whether it be in the sustainability space or transportation. But there is a weird incentive here because right now, the easiest thing to get investment in, whether you're seeking startup investment or whether you're seeking a program inside a corporation, is to say, I can replace this person, the vertical AI agent use case, I can replace this person with AI, which almost always means you're creating a less intelligent version of a person, but cheaper. And there's like, there's a genuine tension in the market there just now where the possibilities are huge in one direction, but there's also an incentive to go for bad use cases. Because, and I guess even in the example of the kind of breakup agents, there's no doubt you can find some bad boyfriends you can sell that to, right? There's a commercial use case for it. But we're at a weird spot where we're kind of, you know, I think innovative people are excited by the possibilities of AI. But the thing that's very loud in the world just now is actually making processes less intelligent rather than more.
The issue is today, shareholder value, okay, and shareholder return is trumping everything else, okay? I don't care if you get me a less smarter kind of algorithm, but if it can do 80, 90% cost optimization, and I don't really care if along the way I lose 2-3 people who can design with their own creativity and ingenuity, I don't care about that. If you get me this algorithm that can give me 90% cost optimization, at the end of the day, shareholder return, shareholder value, and profit goes up, you know, that's all they care about. And now more than ever, corporations are, they're just looking at the bottom line. Board members are looking at the bottom line. Investors are looking. So when they see an AI agent that could go into any solution that can take away the people, increase the productivity, and reduce the cost, you know, it's kind of like it's a no-brainer. And this is where we're losing the human genuity. We're giving it to a machine to do the work. And don't get me wrong, I'm all for AI doing the redundant, monotonous work that goes on and on. It's very repetitive. I mean, the value for a human to do that is zero. You know, I would, you know, there's nothing there. But for it to be, that's perfect for AI. But unfortunately, that is not only, I mean, it's starting there, but it's beginning to expand elsewhere.
You've got to have the human in between always. The human is the most important. You know, at the end of the day, NI, that's native intelligence, always will out-trump AI. I always believe that. And it's at the end of the day, we just got to put the right balance in place. And I think what I call is basically the human in the loop scenario. We always need to put that on. It's not about automation. It's about augmentation. That's very important. It's not just about automation. The best AI startups don't replace humans. They make them 10 times more efficient. I think that should be the way we look at it. We have Copilot-style tools for lawyers. We have them for coders, designers, everything. They're actually augmenting, but they're not replacing. So I think that's what we should, when we are talking about AI, we should keep these factors in our mind always. And that'll actually help balance this. Replacement of people, yes, will happen. But I think if we upskill and reskill, we'll still have them for more, you know, for other users. But our bottom line is, Yes, there is an obvious threat. There's an imminent threat always. But I think it can be mitigated very easily by reskilling. And that's what we're doing. A lot of companies in India, everyone, almost every corporate is reskilling their employees with certain different levels of AI skills. I think today, if I don't have the numbers right now, no numbers have been taken, but almost 79 to 80% of Indian corporates, and I work with a lot of them, have brought in AI as part of the training right from day one, right from freshers, right up to the middle and mid management, senior management as well. So, and of course, underlined by the ethics aspect. So you don't bring in the ethics, you don't have AI.
So this has been described as the mask off era. It's the era of less filters, of less holding back. We're obviously seeing, once again, a Trump White House where whatever's on the top of your mind, just say it. Doesn't matter. What this has brought with it is an interesting space for sustainability and then also just what the rules are. So just recently, a Texas-led multi-state coalition threatened to sue BlackRock, Goldman Sachs, because they were doing too many green things. So where does that put us in not only a sustainability era, but also in this mask-off era? Where do we stand when it comes to sustainability and what the rules are and when corporations are being sued?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because, as you said, like, for example, they stopped the, they're not like the whole Paris Climate Accord, right? The full-on, all the amount of money that was being earmarked to build EV charging stations in the U.S. is gone. They're now, the person running this, the Secretary of Energy, is the fracking oil and gas guy. So it's very strange messages they're sending on the green initiatives, while at the same time, there's kind of like this extremity to just pump as much of the traditional energy supplies as possible. And I think it's just becoming almost a war of the pricing on oil, if you want to look at it that way. But, you know, it goes in so many directions because it's like, that's on the sustainability and the environmental, but like, for example, on some of the governance now, right? If you look at all the checks and balances and doing things right, that's all going. So it's, I mean, it's almost like we are promoting the wild, wild west, you know, and it's becoming a bit kind of out of control. And, you know, it was already, there were companies were already trying. I mean, they were getting the McKinsey's and the Boston Consulting Group and all, getting all these consulting companies to help them implement ESG. This is the irony behind it, is that ESG hasn't with any company really reached a mature stage of adoption and execution. So it didn't even have the chance to live its life, you know, and now it's being cut up into little pieces and it's being miscommunicated, not just around ESG, DEI, diversity, equity and inclusion. And again, it's like everybody is kind of going after everyone. And I think there needs to be still a party, an organization that pushes to support this, you know, either. You know, I mean, if it's corporations that, you know, the people on top don't want to listen, it should be the employees. I mean, there still needs to be a practice of some level of environmental accord, sustainable, kind of lifestyle or execution. And then also on the governance side. But I think what's happening now is the message seems to be that everything that's going to be good for profit, good for money, you know, good for the corporations, good for the people on top is kind of the direction we're taking. And, you know, it unfortunately, it's almost like what can the people at the bottom do or the little people or the employees do? But it's still people can still practice and I mean, I'm still for the electric vehicle cars. I mean, my wife has an electric car, and we're here in UAE where it was like, you know, and we have an electric car. So it still needs to be something that you as an individual have to commit and interpret, and not let kind of all this chaos move you in any direction. I mean, an example would be our friend Mark Zuckerberg. When it was during the Biden administration, he was doing everything Biden told him to do. And he said, you know, I agree with you. We need to be careful and everything. And then as soon as Trump took over, he said, Biden made me do that. Biden made me put filters. Biden made me do that. Biden, 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 you know, and now he's taking it off. Like, look, I like the idea that sometimes telling people what's on your mind and not filtering is authentic, is real. And you're communicating the message straight without any sort of, you know, cooking the message, right? There's nothing wrong with that. But when, for me, with the messaging that's becoming abusive, with the social media, which at some point becomes a concern for me because I'm a father with a daughter, with children, and I don't like the idea that social media could coerce them or manipulate them in any way, you know, without filters, that bothers me. You know, it bothers mm-hmm. me that social media becomes the form of communication and the form of advertising, and you have innocent individuals like my daughter is 11, my son is 8, can access this information and be completely skewed in a weird dimension. And that bothers me. And that for me is the biggest concern when it comes to no filters.
Yeah. And I think as well, Shafiq, it's interesting here for leaders who want to drive an ESG or sustainability agenda. There is maybe a moment for that group to sort of embrace the mask off element slightly, in the sense of actually, for a number of years now, if you've been driving an ESG agenda, you've been able to frame it as compliance. Like inevitably, exactly, these things are going to happen. What people now need to be much more self-confident doing is saying, one, there are opportunities here, especially internationally, and especially in sense of even in the sense of in America, it may be there's a pushback against ESG as such. But wait, if you're a corporation or someone says you have to deliver on a Made in America pledge, because that's a hell of a lot of accountability for your supply chain and transition that you're going to have to go through. So I think it's a moment for ESG leaders to really embrace the idea of communication being a positive, being a core part of what they do, and starting to tap into some of the other messages, I guess, which is partly around growth, it's partly around energy independence and your part of the world, it's partly around long-term planning. Because I think it's just really interesting, I guess, you're joining us from Abu Dhabi. There's a lot of parts of the world that you might have thought would be keener on the old world in terms of energy production, but you've already moved. So I think there's an interesting thing. You've already adapted. You're already driving around in electric cars. You've already made the investments nationally to pivot yourself for the future. So I think, you know, yes, there's the element of Wild West just now, but things are certainly less clear. But it's not clear that everything necessarily falls back to the way it was before globally. You know, that's definitely something for people to hold on to.
And what's really interesting, Nick, to what you just said right now is, like, haven't we learned anything from COVID? You know, haven't we learned that basically none of us, we're not islands, right? We're not siloed. We're not separate of one another. We're not like, oh, just because it's a company in Texas or one in Abu Dhabi or one in, UK. Oh, you know what? I don't really care. These guys can do whatever they want. Haven't we learned anything about supply chain? Haven't we learned anything about globalization? Haven't we even learned anything that when we pivot to basically one supply chain or one supplier is stuck, we need to pivot to another, that we may need to work with somebody in other parts of the world? Haven't we learned the fact that we're all connected? Because when we sit there and when corporations start behaving as single siloed, oh, this is what we're going to do and this is what we need to do, you know, it's affecting everyone around them, you know. And not only that, we are also, you know, as not just as countries or not just as individuals and corporations, but all of us are connected, because at the end of the day, we all depend on each other for some form of resource. I mean, earlier Raj was talking about the electric car. The electric car mm-hmm. today, what is the electric car? It's a battery and a motor, an electric motor, right? The lithium, just to produce that lithium, you need to mine that, you know, it's considerable amount of mining, you know, and now as we look to produce other batteries, there's, you know, so we're all connected. We cannot just be so ignorantly and arrogantly saying, what I do is my business. It's nothing got to do with you. You know, we can't go there, right?
Yeah. And especially if you are a global company, the risks around sustainability are still there in the sense of different governments around the world, different regulators, different customer bases are going to be holding you accountable for things that you do now. And we know to the point in terms of, you know, learning from history, we know that comes back to haunt you at a later point, unless you're making some kind of adaptation by the time you get to the, you know, you get to a point where there's a problem popping up in some part of the world. So I think there's genuinely, I think it's maybe just that kind of core point of, so far, mask off has meant entirely people who are opponents of ESG driving the agenda. There might be a moment where some people who understand that and understand that even from a cold business risk perspective, start to communicate what they see the future being more proactively.
Sabre, one of the biggest tech companies in travel, has announced some huge changes in their leadership team this week with a few new job titles in the C-suite. How important is the leadership team when it comes to a big company? Because what happens when these new job titles turn up in industry leaders? And how does it affect the change in the industry? Is it something that everyone starts copying? Is it something that everyone looks towards? So when we have these category leaders making these changes, what is the knock-on effect? And how do we process that as people are engaging with those industries?
I think new titles also signal a new wave of things happening in around the world. Like we have a chief CAIO, or chief AI officer. We have the CMO, the chief metaverse officer. We have a chief sustainability officer. It's a strong signal that something big is shifting. There's a paradigm shift in the way things are moving. New roles means new priorities, of course. And a lot of this, but besides all this, what we really need is we have these new roles, yes. But these new roles actually do a lot of things which people don't really see beyond the title itself. A, they set direction. I believe that the leadership determines these type of roles determine the long-term vision and the priorities of an organization. You know, in the earlier days, Tim Cook used to focus on supply chain and service, while Steve Jobs always was on breakthrough products. That's like a paradigm shift. And new titles came around that time in fast-moving industries, etc. All this will happen. But more important, I think, is inside the company. These new roles means new priorities, new strategies, not just experiments. These new roles bring together a new infused energy into the overall strategy. You know, if a major company creates new leadership roles, others start following. You know, once in the earlier days, banks that started hiring chief data officers, the data governance then became the industry standard. I think this is exactly what's going to be happening in the AI space or the blockchain space or the metaverse space. Investors and regulators also are now going to take notice. If every Fortune 500 company starts adding, say, a chief climate officer or chief sustainability officer, there will be some sort of standardization and the ESG regulations will start getting tighter. And therefore, sustainability, ESG, all these words will not be used, abused, or misused. Let's look at this. You know, when Google and Meta created the chief AI scientists, AI became a core business driver. And almost every company is hiring AI experts. See how these things change. 5 years back, we didn't have these titles or we didn't think about these titles. Today we have. Chief sustainability officers of the CSOs, energy, finance, retail, all these have made ESG reporting a little more mainstream now. You know, in earlier when the metaverse was really popular, now it's not so much. It signaled a temporary shift towards, you know, when we had the chief metaverse office, it actually made a shift towards immersive digital experiences. Those roles, some of the roles have disappeared, but they forced companies to think about new strategies, Web3 strategies. I think titles add not only flavor, color, but they add that little bit of edge, I think, which make other people sit up and say, hey, right, something new is happening. It also is a great motivator, in my opinion. So I think these titles are good. it helps brings about a little more, you know, it brings a little more flavor to the vanilla ice cream, I say. It brings in the chocolates and the vegan. I think that's good. Also, it opens up more doors, you know, especially in countries like India, where we have a lot of people who are in the tech space, and give them more. In a country which is struggling with, you know, getting employment all the time, these are new avenues, and that becomes global, because sometimes you will not get the right people in a certain geography. You can now have remote work after COVID. Remote work is now accepted. So we have a lot of remote workers in India working as chief AI officers for a lot of American companies and international companies. I'm doing myself for several. I have several hats myself. So yes, I know these things are great. So you can, it's apart from being a bragging rights, gives you some bragging rights as well. But more important, brings about a scene where there's a paradigm shift and more innovation can take place, not just experimentation. We need innovation. Experiments.
I'm going to be a devil's advocate in this, Raj. I'm really sorry with that. I'm going to be the devil. I think that before a company starts putting titles, they have to have a real coherent message from the leadership team. Okay, they need to start saying that they need to communicate their message, communicate their philosophy, communicate their mission, their mission vision. They need to make sure, first of all, that everybody understands what this company is doing. And then finally, as they create these titles within the leadership team, they need to be titles that mesh with the direction of the company, right? I think today, Raj, and forgive me for saying this, but I think today the reason why a lot of these companies are putting chief AI scientists and chief AI data is because they're trying to create order. They're trying to give the illusion of order in a world that is already in chaos. Okay. We are not in control of AI. Okay. We pretend in a way that we are in control of AI, but we're not. Okay. In some shape or form, it's become more powerful than us. Sometimes we can easily figure out what it's doing. Sometimes we don't know what it's doing. I read an article that says that when you look at, the neuron, basically when you look at the algorithm within Google, right, when they're using the neuron, and basically when it goes into the algorithm, when the data goes into the algorithm and the algorithm does what needs to do, you don't always know what the output is going to be. I mean, you can figure it out, but you don't really have 100% control, of that output. So I think creating titles in leadership, it's good, because obviously you want to create the structure and an order. But before you go to titles, like for me, leadership is not about the titles. Leadership is about getting the work done. It's about delivering what you are meant to deliver and taking responsibility for when things go wrong. You know, you have too much today within leadership. Too much is like, all the good I will celebrate, and all the bad, it's on you. It's your fault. Okay. But we're the ones who should nurture and empower the team. We're the ones that should communicate to the team where we're going and what we're doing. You know, even till now, the 15 years I've been working in the family business, 2010, I would always tell people, I will go to any meeting, I'll meet with anybody, I'll be there on one condition. You never, ever tell them I'm the son of the owner. Okay. I don't want to go into any meeting. I don't want to go into any discussion where I am the son of the owner. I'm an employee like you, and we're both trying to succeed in this company. So then by some gossip, somehow always somebody would say, oh, did you know who you were talking to? Right. And it would just, you just see how immediately some of these dynamics change. You know, and I hate it. Okay. I don't like going into, I don't go into any meeting with titles. I go into a meeting until this day, even as chief technology officer, you know, the team would always say, oh, I'm the chief technology officer. I just go in and I say, you know, hi, my name is, I'll introduce myself, you know, and of course in a business card, but it's not about the titles or the people sitting around. I mean, where this becomes too much like a status quo, right? We're just all sharing, you know, he's the CTO, he's the CIO. I'm like, at the end of the day, we're here to solve a problem, okay? We're coming together as a team to solve a problem. And we get caught up with our titles. You know, I think to some extent, people get caught up with their titles.
Yeah, it's interesting, though, actually, because I've worked in family companies at different points. And actually, I think one of the things that's good about the family having titles is a title's like a job you can understand. So it's not just their opinion goes, so to speak, it's that they're accountable for something, whether that's the technology or the marketing or something else like that. Which I guess that's the you know, the interesting thing with job titles in the C-suite. So in the Sabre example, they've got a chief marketing officer for the first time, also got a chief administration officer for the first time. But I think the thing that's really important about that is less the job titles, to your point. It's the fact that there are people who are accountable for those things now. And that the business, when it puts them onto the leadership team, kind of says these are the key accountabilities that therefore plays into, I guess, Raj, your kind of point in terms of, you know, what is it this company's actually trying to do long term? And who are the people that are on the line for doing those things? That's the shift.
Yeah, I mean, listen, definitely in the world of cybersecurity, now you've got, you know, you need to have a certain additional C-suites and need to sit in on the board because cybersecurity itself has become, you know, a science, a KPI, a serious measure of the success of a company is going to be based on its cybersecurity resilience and capability. I mean, Satya Nadella at some point took his whole executive team and said, your bonus is going to be tied to this case, you know, to the security and safety of our products. Okay. Yeah. So he's taking it seriously. And, you know, that is important when you have the CISO and you have the chief data and the chief security officer and the chief and the chief and the chief. I mean, they all come together. You know, it's like you step into an environment. I'm a manager. Who's doing the job? You know, so it's important. Don't get me wrong. It's important with structure. It's important with order. But don't let it be kind of the way you drive your leadership initiatives.
We're on to our last topic, and this is a sort of an interesting one, just because it's a bit of a silly one. So it was the Super Bowl last night. Does this even matter outside of America? And is this an event that we can use to learn something as innovators in business, or has this just really gone past its prime?
I'll go for that. I think Super Bowl, like the last Super Bowl, had about almost, 62 million people watching it? Which I've been seeing that. I don't really follow too much of Super Bowl, but there are a lot of my cousins which do, and they told me there's 62.5 million or 63 million people watched Super Bowl, which is a huge increase from the time last time. But that actually is eyeballs. It has a global impact, no matter which way you look at it. Yes, it's not. It may not be popular in some countries, but it has a global impact. It brings. I've seen it. You know, the halftime shows, the commercials. They actually bring in a lot of globally recognized celebrities and artists and all. If that is something, it appeals to people outside the US. There were a lot of performances by international stars, and that's drawn a lot of global eyeballs as well. The marketing reach for the brands is massive. High-profile campaigns, commercials, these are actually now, in fact, I feel Super Bowl is a great eyeball builder. You know, it's got strategic timing, it's got aligning the product launches, major announcements, everything with the, you know, it has the right timing. Emotional storytelling is a very big thing which I feel the Super Bowl has for a lot of people across, in fact, across all geographies. It's got humor, it's got nostalgia, there are a lot of messages, it connects with the audience and a large audience at that. It's got a lot of celebrity partnerships which you talked about, new trends. It talks about the artificial intelligence in the recent Super Bowl ads, basically highlights the importance of all these. Although it's US-centric, yes, but I think the influence extends globally. A lot of valuable insights and a great branding and an advertising opportunity for a lot of brands, not just American brands, but outside America as well. So I think that's my take on the Super Bowl, although I'm not a big fan of it myself, but I think there's a lot for a lot of marketing people. It's a real bounty.
I mean, I agree with Raj. Listen, the Super Bowl is no different than watching the Olympics, right? When we are all gathered around to watch the Super Bowl, we're watching another world event on so many levels. I mean, one, we expect there to be performances because it's going to be, you know, it's the Super Bowl. So everyone's waiting to see what's the performance, what's the event. So for those who don't really care about the football, they still want, you know, to watch the performance. the brands today, these brands are global, right? So whether I'm sitting in America or I'm sitting in Abu Dhabi, Microsoft Copilot, Google Gemini, you know, a Ford truck, you know, what is it? Coors Light and beer commercials, everything. I mean, the brands are global. So I'm going to be curious, if I'm a fan of one of these brands, to see what kind of commercial, because people know they are the most expensive commercials. These guys, advertising agencies, they go to sleep during the, and they try to do a lot of, you know, click advertising on the web. But when it comes to Super Bowl time, they spend big money to do these. And that's what Raj is saying. They bring the celebrities, they bring all sorts of people. I mean, you know, Matthew McConaughey is doing the commercial for Salesforce. Okay. So, I mean, these guys are playing, are paying big money. So again, for us, that's entertainment, you know? And we're looking forward to seeing both the commercials as well as the event. However, let me talk about football. Okay. So my cousin lives in LA. He loves watching football. He always takes, whenever I go visit him, he's either watching football at his house or he takes me to some bar to watch football. And I tell him, George, you know, you just watch this thing and people are running around passing the ball. I mean, what's so fun about it? And it wasn't until he explained it to me that now I actually enjoy watching it. And I'm going to disperse this myth on you guys. But anyway, so he told me football is like playing chess. I'm like, what? What are you talking about? So basically he explained how all the defenders kind of block each other. And either the quarterback or the guy that runs with the ball tries to find a way to get through and run with the ball. And it's all strategy. So then I said to him, really? And so now when I watch it, I'm looking at how the strategy is. So during Christmas, my grandfather, my wife's father, sorry, was watching it. And my son, Aiden, was sitting next to him. And he was explaining it to him, you know. And he got into it. Aiden likes to play soccer. But when he got into it, I found Aiden every day going to my wife's father and saying, you know, is there American football today? Can we watch American football? And he got into it, right? So
yeah.
So I think when you blend entertainment with strategy, you have a global phenomenon and event that connects with everyone.
I think it's interesting as well, Sophie, which is that maybe the NFL, you know, of all the sports leagues in the world, NFL have really understood that combination of entertainment, sport, and fashion and those kind of things together. Yeah, I think in some ways, NFL for a long time has been trying to grow internationally. And I almost feel like they're being so successful right now, almost because they're actually in some ways making the actual sport slightly secondary to everything else. People become an NFL fan in Europe because they watch a Netflix documentary, and then through that they start to follow big things happening, and then it becomes this kind of runway for brands and for influencers and such, like through the Super Bowl. It's like they've really understood that if you really want to grow a sport now, you grow it as an entertainment brand rather than as a sporting experience. That's the thing they've really understood just now. And it might be they're about to have that kind of breakthrough they've been trying to have for a long time, where it actually starts to become something that, you know, kids in UAE, kids in the UK, kids in Germany, kids in India start to actually pay attention to, rather than just being like a weird event. They just feel like they're quite close to a breakthrough moment on lots of this.
Oh, actually, the home box cable packages here, they were advertising like a week before, you know, if you want to watch the Super Bowl, here's a cable package. Yeah. And this is here in the UAE. So there were people. There's some of my meetings today got canceled to tomorrow because everybody was watching the Super Bowl last night. So they're like,
really?
You know,
I heard that's a sign. Yeah. That is a sign. That is a thing.
Yeah. It's like, we'll talk to you we'll see you on Tuesday, Shafi, because Monday we're going to be late to work because we're watching Super Bowl on Sunday. Because, of course, it's past midnight. So,
yeah.
It's also, I think, the last bastion of TV, the TV commercial as we know it.
Yeah.
Because we don't have this everybody is watching moment anymore. You stream it when you want to watch it, and you don't. So this is the last sort of space where you're actually seeing a real-time ad. And everyone's seeing it at the same time. So I think there is this sort of that nostalgia for that shared moment, which is always going to be a part of the Super Bowl. Not because it's a football event, but because it's really the only time where you can have this shared content. and you know everyone's going to see it in the same way you're seeing it. It's not showing up in my algorithm or your algorithm, or because the stuff I've seen on the Super Bowl is very, very different to the stuff Nick's been seeing about the Super Bowl. I've only been seeing Kendrick Lamar's performance. I've seen nothing else. And, you know, so there is that idea of a shared experience, which is so sorely lacking in our sort of very dispersed world right now. So we've come to the end of this really sort of in-depth and insightful podcast. One of the things we like to ask before we wrap up is what your cultural pick of the week is. It can be the Super Bowl if you want to. And this is the TV show, movie, book, piece of art, anything that you think has inspired you culturally this week. Raj, what's been your cultural pick of the week?
I read a book which was really old. I had read that book when I was probably in my 20s, called Thriving in Chaos by Alvin Toffler. I read that book once again, and it said, give me a new perspective about chaos, actually. And we live in a chaotic world. When we talk about AI, that's chaotic. Now, I tried to link that book with AI, and it sort of ignited me, and I'm actually writing a book now. The new chaos with AI. I started reading that, and I thought, well, that's something. This book is old. When I'm saying old, I read it when I was doing my management in my 20s. I'm in my 60s now. 40 years later, I picked up the same book. I've still got the whole copy. And I think that was my kick for the season. I think that's my New Year resolution also. I decided to write something. But I think I'm going to, that was totally different. Somebody had asked me to write something on blockchain. I said, no, that's okay. That's fine. That's been done and dusted. Let's write something new. So my thriving on chaotic, and I'm writing on thriving in the chaotic AI world now. I'm going to retitle it, but that's what I'm writing on. And that's what inspired me this season as well.
It's one thing we can always count on is chaos.
Yes, you can. Chaos. Always there. All around.
Shafiq, your cultural pick of the week?
Well, I've read this book. I'm sure everybody knows about it, Life of Pi. It's a very popular book, and everybody's read it. And so my birthday was November, just passed, and they actually had Life of Pi playing in the theaters here in Abu Dhabi. And my wife and I went. She got it for me as a pre-birthday outing, and we weren't expecting anything. We're like, you know, what could this be? You know, I mean, animals, and you know. It was beautiful. It was such a beautiful performance. It brought back the magic of India and everything about it. I've never been to India, but you just were captured in such a magical setting. And for a minute there, I was not thinking about AI or blockchain or autonomous cars or EVs. For once, I felt non-digital, non-connected, and human again, okay? And it felt good because it was just so tangible, so human connection with the whole story, but the actor was phenomenal. Everything about the performance was amazing. And what it shows that at the end, like what you leave out of there with a very strong thought and perspective, you say, we have to make sure that we let technology play its part without eliminating what makes us human after all.
Yeah. Nick, anything from you?
Well, I'll just wrap up as well. Actually, I'll change it a little bit there, actually, because I think there's a really nice thing which is happening in the UK anyway, which is cinemas are starting to put on old movies again. As in like very old movies, like going back through the archive. Probably partly because cinemas are struggling a little bit, but I've just been really knocked out recently by going back to see old films that you've known quite well, but seeing it in a cinema setting, partly, I think, because of the sound and the big screen, but also because that seeing some of those movies in a social setting is just entirely different. So I saw A Brief Encounter over the weekend. It's very, like, so I would just say, maybe my cultural pick is going to the cinema in general, but actually going in particular for some of those old movies that are back on the big screen. Just now,
there's something that's happening here as well. But they're playing a lot of early 2000 films, so I feel like I'm reconnecting with my youth. And they're also charging the prices from early 2000, so it's a whole experience of sort of being young again, going to watch these films and seeing them on the big screen again. It's been a very interesting time. Well, Thank you to everyone for joining us. We hope that you're all caught up on the world of innovation this week. If you want to get access to label sessions for your brand or have your teams mentored by our leaders, get in touch via our website or any of the social networks around. We're on all of them. See you next week.